funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How economically secure are Texas women, and what special challenges exist for those taking on ever greater roles in financially supporting their families? This year, about 161,000 North Texas households living in poverty are headed by women, who on average earn just 77 cents for every dollar paid to their male colleagues. And many working women struggle to afford housing, health care, and child care. These facts and some potential pathways to economic security are highlighted in a new report prepared by the Center for Public Policy Priorities for the Texas Women's Foundation. Economic Issues for Women in Texas 2014 is available free online. Joining us to discuss it, we have Rosalind Dawson Thompson, President and CEO of the Dallas Women's Foundation, and Frances P. DeVinny. She is a researcher with the Center for Public Public Policy Priorities, and also Texas Kids Count Director there. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
So the point of doing this report and understanding its results is to help Texas women achieve economic security. What does that mean exactly, Rosalind?
Well, first of all, we wanted to make sure that women understood what the issues were and that men understood the issues as well. And so really the purpose of the report was to be able to quantify what specific things stand in a woman's way in the state of Texas from becoming economically secure.
Mm-hmm. And why are households headed by women at greater risk for poverty than those headed by men, Frances?
Well, there's not one simple answer. It's actually a complex web of things that lead women to who head their own households to live in poverty more often. It's things like the wage gap that we can talk a little bit more about as we go on today. It's also about opportunities in education and making sure women have access to that pathway. It's about having supports to be able to keep a job and stay in a job when you have childcare needs. So there's all these building blocks that come together that really can either support a woman in her effort to help support her family, or we can make choices that don't give women that support that they need to be able to be economically secure.
What is the wage gap exactly? This is one of those interesting, hotly debated topics. People talk about how large or small it might be. They talk about the reasons why it exists. What does it mean for purposes of this report?
Well, the wage gap in Texas is actually a little over $9,000 when you're comparing full-time working women to full-time working men. So we're comparing apples to apples here. Now, that's across a lot of different jobs. And so we know that depending on the kind of job you have, you can be paid more or less. There are a lot of things that contribute to this wage gap. One is certainly that women tend to work in lower paying markets than men do. For example, education tends to pay less than some other areas, and more women are concentrated in that area than men. So that contributes to it. Also, we know that for the wage gap, that women leave the workplace often when they have a child for really great reasons, when they have to go and they need to care for their child, or they might leave the workforce in order to take care of an elderly parent or something like that. When you leave the workforce, that does cut into your earnings, and often that can impact the income that you come in at when you re-enter the workforce. So those are two common things. But a third thing can't be discounted. We know from research that there's this whole area that when you look at types of job or when you look at entry into the workforce or exiting the workforce, doesn't account for all of that difference between men and women's pay. There's actually some really interesting research that shows when you have two exact same resumes, one is a woman's name on it and one's a man's name on it, that when you look at, you know, getting first offers with those resumes for the same kind of job, same kind of skills, women get a lower offer than men. So this may be based on what I'm hoping are unconscious biases. They may be based on, you know, actual biases that exist in the workforce. That's still something we're trying to figure out. So it's a very complex relationship.
I'm not defending that at all. But decades ago, maybe the assumption was that a man had to support a family and a woman was earning pin money or something ridiculous like that. But today, it doesn't seem, Rosalind, like anyone is assuming that. Most people understand that in married couples, very often both partners work. And there are many, many, many women heading households. So what do you think explains why some kind of unconscious bias might cause women to receive lower salary offers?
Well, it's a great question, because as we look at the progression of women as breadwinners or co-breadwinners, it's been dramatic. And so over 40 years, the study shows that it's gone from like 40% of all women that are married and have a household with a husband or a significant other, or those who today it's 68%, 67%. So it's a huge increase in the amount that we're counting on for women's salaries to contribute to the family household. And I don't know whether we're still looking at that kind of cultural assumption that, you know, a woman's money doesn't count as much as a man's. But the sheer fact is, in many of these households, it counts more, because these women are either earning, 38% of them are either earning the sole 100% of the money that's coming in the house, or far exceeding the income that their husband's bringing in. So the why of it still points right back to what Francis is talking about, which is, you know, women's jobs are not valued as significantly as men's, even when they're in the exact identical place.
I was really surprised to read the disparity in minimum wage jobs, that minimum wage jobs or lower, 63% of them are held by women.
Yeah.
Women tend to do more of the what we call caring jobs, right? And a lot of times that may be a low-paying home health worker. But a lot of times it's those service jobs too, where it is maybe cleaning in a hotel, or it is, you know, working in a restaurant where you're actually serving the community. And those tend to be those lower-paying jobs. And not only are they lower-paying, they tend to not have benefits either. So these women are working, you know, full-time jobs, if not 50, 60 hours a week, without getting those additional benefits or the pay.
And I suppose single parenthood, it happens all the time and people cope with it. But you're sort of, if there's only one income in a family, most families are automatically at a disadvantage as compared with people where there are partners, both of whom are contributing something financially to the household.
Certainly. And you can really see that in the study, where the differences between a single male head of household, to a married couple, to a female single-headed household, it's incrementally enormously more when it's a single female household with children, and four times as many as a married couple in poverty.
And, of course, there's the issue of paying for child care. If a woman wants to work, mine are older now, but I know it is incredibly expensive to put a kid in a decent daycare program.
And actually what we find is that, you know, if you look across different kinds of daycare, we know there's full day, half day, neighbor care, center care. If you look across all of that, in Texas it costs about, you know, a little over $4,000 a year to send a kid to daycare. And that's on, you know, that's kind of like the 50% mark. Infant care can certainly be twice that amount, we know. If you look at the average single woman's income in Texas, that $4,000 represents almost one of every $5 of her income. So it's a huge chunk that we don't tend to think about when we think about kind of costs for families, and particularly if we're talking about poverty. Poverty doesn't factor in cost of childcare. It doesn't factor in cost of housing. It doesn't factor in all of these other benefits that you might need to be able to support your family. It's strictly based on income. So, you know, when we're looking at who's eligible for child care supports, it's often based on that poverty line, but not really looking at all these extensive costs that are based on, you know, what the centers need to be able to keep running.
How available is child care assistance, or how available are subsidized programs where people can work full-time but maybe not have to bear the expense of having their children cared for?
Well, sadly, not available enough. Mm-hmm. You know, we had in the study, and looking at the Dallas market alone, there are about 11,300 kids that are available and having access to the subsidized child care. But there are about 150,000 that could have it.
Wow.
And so it's a big, big delta. When you look at Fort Worth, then add another 75,000 to that could have it. And compared to those in Fort Worth, it's about a little less than 6,000. So there is help, but not universally nor enough.
And many people have talked about the potential for if certain areas would put in universal pre-kindergarten, at least that's a year that you're not paying for childcare.
That's true. And actually, we've seen many other states and even local areas who've committed the resources to be able to have universal pre-K, not just for kids who are economically eligible, but for all four-year-olds. And some have even expanded it to 3- and 4-year-olds. It's a great early education opportunity for kids to make sure they're ready for kindergarten. We've talked about that a lot over the last several years, about kids being pre-kindergarten ready, being able to read, know their letters, those kinds of things. It's also a great economic boost for families because it allows families, particularly women, to be able to go back into the workforce knowing that their child is going to be in a safe educational environment.
So it sounds like many women could work more hours or could work at all if they had access to affordable child care that is not available right now. What impact might that have on the family poverty rates?
I think it could be enormous. I mean, we really, you know, we haven't extrapolated out, well, it, you know, what if this many more kids and that many more households? But in truth, if you think about the repercussions, as Francis was saying, of earning $24,000 a year and you have one child and that's taking, you know, 20% of your income, what happens if you have two children? You have to begin making some very hard choices of, can I afford to work, if that's what your economic picture really looks like? And so we believe that many, many more women with full-day pre-K and some other supports in place, that is the one critical pipeline support that women need is childcare.
And actually talking about the poverty line, too, as we said earlier, poverty only takes into account income made. It doesn't take into account childcare. It doesn't take into account health debt burden or anything like that. Nationally, there has been some research to show that the poverty rate would actually tick up about 2% if we actually factored in the cost, the high cost of childcare.
So the focus of this report is simply identifying issues and not coming up with solutions and not deciding who would pay for all this. But if we looked at something like more childcare subsidies, Rosalind, do you think this is something that would ultimately have to be a mix of public and private and philanthropic resources? I mean, how could we make this possible and sort of economically viable within a community?
That's what we anticipate, is that it will be ultimately a solution that's a conjoined solution between public, private, and that really is where things have to go. Just to back up to the first part of your statement, though, about why are we just laying it out there and not offering the answers? And part of that is that we think there's an important evolution in this conversation that needs to take place. It's not just, you know, the research being done, us laying out the numbers and then saying, well, that's it. You know, here's what we're going to do. So we felt it was really important to not only issue the statewide study, but to drive it down into 9 specific markets around the state, looking at commonalities and differences in each of those, and having community-based dialogue, because we believe some of the solutions are going to evolve in communities. They're going to start with some solutions that can be found between local government, local philanthropists, that there will be ways that these could really work with local businesses involved as well. And so we're anticipating that we'll see those kinds of solutions, like the very salutary announcement that the Dallas County Commissioners are looking at increasing the minimum wage at Parkland, is a local solution that can have some influence as we move up the ladder in the state.
Are there pretty significant differences in conditions and in issues depending on whether people are living in urban or more rural areas?
Absolutely. Go back to the wage gap discussion that we had earlier. If you're looking at even just within the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's a huge difference in terms of wage gap, and that's reflective of the kinds of jobs that are available for people in those communities. So, for example, the wage gap in Dallas is about $7,400 for women and men. In Fort Worth, it's about $11,000. In Somerville County, $20,000.
Wow.
And that's really based on, you know, there's a lot of mining going on, and those kind of jobs tend to be more male-focused. So just from an income perspective, there's a huge difference. Now, cost of living may differ, too, but I would bet you it's not a $20,000 cost of living difference for families.
We're speaking this hour with Francis P. DeVinney from the Center for Public Policy Priorities and Rosalind Dawson Thompson, President and CEO of the Dallas Women's Foundation, about the report Economic Issues for Women in Texas 2014. You can find a copy free online. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Texas Women Foundation has just issued a report called Economic Issues for Women in Texas 2014. Joining us to discuss it are Frances P. DeVinny of the Center for Public Policy Priorities and Rosalind Dawson Thompson, President and CEO of the Dallas Women's Foundation. If you would like to join the discussion, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. How does the cost of housing play into the economic security or insecurity of any family?
Housing is a huge part of the four building blocks of economic security, if you think about education, childcare, health insurance, and housing. And what we find is that, again, women are disproportionately affected by the cost of housing, particularly single women with children. And so when you look at the housing burden that's faced by women, single women with children in Texas, there's a huge number who are paying over 30% of their income for housing. Now factor that along with child care and you start doing some very seriously depressing math about what it takes to be able to be sufficient in this environment.
Is part of that burden faced more by women, disproportionately by women, because more single women are likely to have care of their children than single men? Is that part of the issue? And therefore, they need larger housing or that sort of thing?
It's both that and that women tend to rent more. Again, mm-hmm. if you take the ripple-down effect of the wage gap, the different challenges that women have, and so economically, can I save enough money if I'm burdened by the cost of child care? Can I save enough money for a down payment? So you have more women renters, and then that also creates another dynamic in terms of, you know, availability of decent space to have with children and what the costs of those spaces are. So you get people pushed further and further out of the center and further and further away from jobs.
The mortgage crisis, Frances, caused a lot of people to sort of question the old saw that, you know, the best investment you can possibly have is purchasing a home. Is there evidence still that one is better off with a mortgage than paying rent?
Well, I think that's a really good question because the problem was not owning a home. The problem was the kind of investment that you were making in terms of the product that you were buying, the interest rates that you were paying, whether it was a balloon loan or not that you got into on the end. So I don't think the question is as much anymore. It was at the time of the crisis, but anymore about the value of owning housing. I think it's really more about being smart and educated and doing more regulation around what banks can do in terms of lending and letting people know what they need to be aware of when they go in to get a loan for a home. And that education has actually been moving forward quite a bit in Texas. There's a lot of local groups who've done amazing work, particularly the United Ways around the state, in volunteer income tax assistance sites where they do financial education for families, particularly low-income families, to help them learn all about not only taxes but about investments and buying a home.
This report didn't mention this, but I imagine you're both familiar with the issue. The earned income tax credit is something that a lot of families qualify for and don't know they qualify for. And I wonder if it's something that you've sort of looked at on the periphery as you look at all these issues.
Absolutely. And part of that discussion certainly arose in a very big way with the Mayor's Task Force on Poverty and the meeting recently in this local community. But I think across the board, around the state, that is definitely a solution that organizations like United Way and others are trying to create venues whereby families are educated about this option. But there's a lot more families that need education than there is bandwidth currently for delivering that information. But that's another very clear, very simple, very opportunistic solution that could be affected if we all chose to go that direction.
And actually, many local areas have actually used the earned income tax credit at refund time to be able to help people find investment opportunities where they can put it in a long-term bond or they can put it in a savings account so that they can build their asset wealth to begin saving for a home or secondary education, post-secondary education. So there's some really great opportunities for families when they do get that earned income tax credit to really start building on their future. And earned income tax credit is really viewed as the single most effective way to help families pull themselves out of poverty.
You mentioned education, and the report calls education, I think it's a pathway to economic security. At the risk of sounding silly, explain how that works.
It's all really down to the pure economics of being able to earn more money with each step of education. And certainly for women, as it is for men, every step of education allows you to really incrementally increase your income capacity. So education is kind of the important first step of saying, you know, you will have a very large difference in your ability to earn, not just now but forever, if you do not pursue the path of education. Our problem is keeping kids and women in particular, young women in particular, in the path of education all the way to completion of an upper degree.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hello. The last speaker's comment is really nails what my comment would be, and that's education. When you look across education across the nation, I'll use your local in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, University of Arlington, Texas at Arlington, 5-year graduation rate there is 15%. In Austin, it's 55%. And my point is that there's a degree of personal responsibility. And I think that too many Americans today are not being held responsible to move forward and to get the education or to get a meaningful trade. And as a result, they are trapped in the quagmire of poverty or at least lower income and job insecurity for their entire lifetime and their children after them.
Well, the report mentions this leaky pipeline of people start with great intentions. They really want to secure an education. What happens for women in particular that gets them enrolled in college and keeps them from finishing?
Well, it's not too terribly different for men. And actually, more women actually enroll and more women graduate than men. But the numbers are still far too low. When you start with eighth graders, by the time you look at a set of eighth graders 11 years later to see what percentage of them actually stay and get their higher ed credential, be it an associate's degree or a four-year college degree, we're down to one of every four girls. And so one of the things that keeps them from being able to finish is the fact that there's a huge increase in the cost of college, even community college these days. And so for most students, this is very different from even 30 years ago or 20 years ago. Most students are working 20 to 40 hours a week. And we know that when students work more than 30 hours a week, that they're much less likely to graduate on time or even graduate at all. So having to work to be able to pay for school is a huge concern for students. And then there's also an issue of the debt burden that they're building during that time. Now, women and men tend to take out about the same amount of debt for college. But when you factor in that wage gap issue, when women are earning less, they actually have a greater debt burden because they have the same amount of debt but less money to actually work with to pay it off. And so that mounting debt burden can really, if you don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, can be a real, can really stop you in your tracks in terms of the path that you see down the road.
So to put this more simply, women end up working more hours ultimately to pay off their college loans than men who had the same amount of money borrowed.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. What could we do to make college more affordable? Universities see their costs rising. I mean, their expenditures are rising on things that some people agree with and some people don't. But is there something on the horizon that could make higher education more affordable in Texas?
Well, there's lots of layers to that question, actually. One of the things that students and families can do is to make sure they actually access the FAFSA application process. So that's the federal assistance where you can apply for Pell Grants and those kind of things. Texas actually has a pretty low percentage of participation and completion in that process. So making sure families access the support that is actually there and available for them is kind of a first step to helping the family. In terms of, you know, cost of college, as you said, colleges are facing the exact same thing that families are in terms of increased costs overall. But we made a choice many years ago in Texas where we were going to deregulate the cost of the support for college and let colleges set their own tuitions, and we pulled back from what we were willing to invest as a state in our public universities. So on balance, in order for colleges to keep up with increased cost and demand, they have to raise their rates. If we as a state and a community believe that higher education is critically important for our people, we have to be investing in those resources to help provide an opportunity and provide people that pathway to higher ed.
How much more affordable is health insurance today than it was before the initial implementation of Obamacare?
This report was produced prior to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and so what data we have that's actually published in the report, and I'll defer to Francis for the second part of the question, but what's published in the report was really almost to set a benchmark to see what do we look like in the state currently in terms of underinsured, uninsured, women in particular, and we'll see what kind of change we have a year hence, 2 years hence, when we do the study again and look at how the uptake on the Affordable Care Act has changed that picture.
So in terms of your question about the cost of health care, it makes a huge difference for families who are above the poverty line but still don't make enough money to be able to pay for health insurance out of their pockets. So say, for example, a family that's making, you know, $27,000 a year, family of four. Their health insurance premiums could be around $8,700 a year to cover their whole family. Through the health insurance marketplace, because they would be low income and they would be eligible for a premium assistance, they could get up to about $8,400 a year. So then there's only about $300 left that they have to come up with. That's huge. That's enormous for families. The catch for Texas is that we have a coverage gap. So we opted not to expand Medicaid. And because of that, the premium assistance is not available for families who live under the poverty line, but they also can't buy into Medicaid or get Medicaid through the state. And so there's a huge proportion of our population who still has the same exorbitant cost. They may have an $8,700, you know, premium per year as well, but they don't get that additional assistance that somebody who's just barely over the poverty line gets. So it depends on who you're talking about. For our lowest income families, it's still incredibly expensive. For slightly, you know, slightly better off families, you're getting a lot of help.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We know that women make a lot of the purchasing decisions in families, and this is not a focus of this report, but are women also, is it your sense that women are making more of the savings and investment decisions within families?
There is a good bit of evidence showing that across a lot of dimensions in the country, and I think in Texas as well, that the investment, well, I'll say you could actually just look at all the commercial banks focus on women as a market, and you could say, yes, women are making a lot more of the investment decisions for their families. So I think that that is very true at a certain socioeconomic level. But I think the reality of the other side of it is that women are often woefully undereducated in financial literacy, financial ability, and financial confidence. And so the push-pull here is that you have a certain part of the market that's more educated, more in touch with their assets, that it are driving investment decisions and purchasing decisions. Consumerism, let's set that aside, but just strictly investment decisions. But if you have women who have had no exposure at all to financial literacy, this is why it's very celebratory that we've got the new mandated financial literacy in math classes, you know, in Texas is a great step forward to be able to give women and men the opportunity to understand what their assets are and how to manage them. But I think that's the dark side of this investment picture and consumer picture, is that women often do not have the equipment they need to be financially literate.
What accounts for that lack of confidence, do you think? And or is it simply that men maybe, and I'm generalizing here, some men are overconfident about their ability to manage their own money?
I think historically we have, and this goes back to some of the STEM education discussions as well, Chris, is that women have not been encouraged in school in the same way as men to pursue economics, mathematics, you know, so there's been a kind of skew in our educational system that kind of parsed the girls out over to the soft side and the guys out to the hard side. And we've come a long way around that, but not fully around it. And so there, we have a number of organizations that we have supported that show that teaching these subjects in a gender-neutral fashion makes this information much more accessible and apprehendable by young women. But we have sort of skewed our teaching to a masculine voice, you know, for mathematics and the hard stuff, and a softer voice for the other. And that is changing, but it's changing slowly.
The Dallas Women's Foundation has advocated something called gender lens investing. Can you talk about what that is?
I'd love to. No, we believe that as a foundation supporting and advancing issues for women and girls in our region and our state, that it's important to also put our working assets to work for women and girls. And so while part of us is a philanthropy that is raising money and giving grants to programs that benefit women and girls across many dimensions of these economic building blocks, if you will, we also think it's important to put our working assets to work for women. So we're investing capital assets in investments that are gendered to help provide mezzanine funding for women business owners and other investment vehicles that ultimately benefit women and their economic prosperity. And so we think that's a good balance to the philanthropy that's bringing people up that might be challenged, as well as taking those and pushing it forward for those who are in business and seek to have a career in that.
Frances, did you get a sense for how much extra women and families need to have in a given month, in a given year, in order to begin any kind of significant savings program? Maybe not even with a goal in mind, but just how much extra do you need to have enough to put away?
So we actually did a separate research study called the Family Budgets. It's our Better Texas Family Budgets. And we looked at how much it would actually cost on top of your basic needs, housing, childcare, all of those, to be able to save for college, to be able to save for retirement, to be able to save for a rainy day. And on average, when you're looking at very basic savings, just to get started, you would need, depending on your family size and all that and where you live, you would need between $3,000 and $8,000 additional every month to be able to put back to start doing that kind of savings. So you can see why a lot of people look at those numbers and think, oh my gosh, I can't possibly begin to make those kind of investments, and then they make no investments at all. What's really interesting about the data is that we know that even with a small amount of savings, even with $100 in a savings account for a child's college, they're 7 times more likely to apply and actually finish college knowing that you've made that commitment.
Wow. Frances P. DeVinney is with us from the Center for Public Policy Priorities, also Rosalind Dawson Thompson of the Dallas Women's Foundation. We're talking about the Texas Women's Foundation report, Economic Issues for Women in Texas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Texas Women's Foundation has issued a new report called Economic Issues for Women in Texas. You can find a copy free online by Googling. Joining us to talk about it, we have Frances P. DeVinney of the Center for Public Policy Priorities and Rosalind Dawson Thompson of the Dallas Women's Foundation. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Stephanie on the phone in Dallas. Hey, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
So I'm calling, first of all, I have to say this topic is getting nearer and dearer to my heart as I get older. I actually work for El Centro's West Campus as a peer coach. So I work with students who are coming in testing developmental ready. So they come in and they're not college level ready for their classes yet. And there is a high percentage of dropout. The program that I work with is actually called Coaching for Completion, which is to help students complete college. I work with mostly women. The thing that I heard that really just struck me was the comment about healthcare and what the government's healthcare website has done. I was really, really hopeful that that would open some doors for me and my family because we are below the poverty line. And what ended up happening was my daughters were immediately put on Medicaid and my husband and I were charged. The cheapest one available to us was $380. And I can't do that on a $16,000 a year income. And I'm here, you know, in my 30s, a full-time college student myself, you know, thinking how we really need to reach these young women as soon as possible to get them into the whole process. You know, I'm a first-time college goer and in my family, and I work with the students that I work with are first-time college goers. And what I hear all the time is, you know, can you come in for a session? That's what I will ask them. And what I will hear is, you know, well, I've got to find a babysitter, things like that. I never hear that from my men students. I just don't.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry it's been so hard for you, and I don't know that we have solutions necessarily today, but maybe, ladies, you'd like to comment?
Well, so the data from the report that we published with the Texas Women's Foundation, that we worked with the Texas Women's Foundation to support, was showed that actually women like Stephanie are much higher represented in the uninsured ranks than women who are under 18, because we have opportunities like the Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicaid, or women who are over 65 because we have Medicaid and Medicare for that. We have made a choice that we are going to focus on kind of the higher end and lower end of our age groups, and we're not really going to focus on trying to make sure that women in their 30s, 40s, 50s have access to health care. The problem with that is that these are women who are in their prime earning years. They are, as we've seen from earlier data we talked about, the primary breadwinners of their family in many cases, and they are the age for childbearing. And so that's a really huge expense. And when you have a woman who is the primary breadwinner of a family who doesn't have health insurance, and really we're talking about it as a financial shield. It's actually almost like a financial product for families to protect them from crisis or from even positive things that cost a lot of money, like having a baby, right? And so if you don't have health insurance and you run into one of these really expensive moments in your life, that can cause financial ruin for a family. And you can imagine in Stephanie's situation that she described, you know, if she had a car wreck or if she got pregnant and had another child, what that could potentially do to their income when she's full-time student and, you know, working as well.
Well, to that end, we have an email here from Matthew, who writes, I'd like to make a comment about poverty and women or any family with a child who has special needs. The extra cost of those needs can be staggering compared to the relatively simple costs of normal child care that we've discussed. If this happens in a single-parent household, it almost guarantees poverty because that parent will not be able to work at all while school is out for the summer.
There you go. There you go.
Where can families go? Where can women go? I mean, it seems like there are some solutions for people who fall below the poverty line. But again, there's that gap of people that technically speaking are not living in poverty. But, you know, if you look around and sort of look at the way they're trying to make ends meet, their lives are quite challenging.
Well, first, we have to be very clear about what poverty means. So that is a federal definition based on how many people you have living in your family. And for a family of three, it's about $18,000, a little over $18,000 a year. So if you make $19,000 a year for a family of three, you're not living in poverty.
So tell that to someone, some family of three, right, making $19,000.
Exactly. Right. So it's a very hard line cutoff and a pretty conservative one as well. So, you know, as you said, people who might be just living right above poverty are still struggling to make ends meet but may not be eligible for some of the supports that we have in place. For many families, it's not just about kind of being able to find good child care, being able to find, you know, an opportunity for health care. It's also about just kind of the constant deterioration and stress that creates from the financial stress, the emotional stress of being able to provide for your family in this economy. And we've seen that that has huge impacts on children as they're developing. We call it toxic stress, and that's much higher in families who are living below the poverty line. Children who experience toxic stress are more likely to have emotional difficulties as they're going through life. They're much more likely to be held back in school. They're much more likely to have health problems. And so, you know, it's not just about the building blocks, which are critically important, but it's also about the kind of the emotional and the psychological toll that it takes, and that doesn't impact just the family. that impacts the community, and it impacts our state and our world. When women aren't supported, you actually have a crumbling network of support for the community and the state.
Do you find, Rosalyn, that women in this community sort of look around and are we relating to our sisters based on these issues, or are we thinking, that's your problem, this is my problem? How unified do you feel people are around these issues?
I think coming closer and closer together. I've been very encouraged within our community of the collaboration among many, many organizations, from United Way, the Community Foundation, with us, Dallas Women's Foundation, much more interest in collaborative thinking around these issues, which is going to produce the kind of thing you were hinting at a minute ago, which is, where do people go? Well, right now we can give you a list of 17 agencies or 700 agencies and circumstances and housing authorities and different realities that are now in all disparate locations. And
you're taking a day off work
each
time you go.
You got to take a day off work mm-hmm. every time you go. And so we're making it so hard to get out of this situation. So part of our goal with this report was to say, four critical things. Focus on the four critical things. What can we do to support them? Who's providing them? And now let's look at how we can coalesce some of those services together, whether that's a choice that nonprofits make to cohabit and make things available in a simpler fashion, whether it is making resources available from business, whether it is recharging business with the opportunities to say, how do you want to keep people at work? You know, how do you want to do retention? How do you want to look at the facts that, you know, policies that you set and practices you set in your business itself can contribute to the solution? So I think that there's a greater conversation that we hope will evolve around how we as a community can make it easier for people to find the path out, not door by door by door, but through one single door.
I want to go back to the wage gap issue once again. Are there ways that women can proactively defend themselves against unconscious bias or company policy or whatever, and ensure that, assuming they're doing good work, they are earning as much as that job can possibly pay?
I'm going to let Frances talk statistically about this, but I'll talk experientially about mm-hmm. this and what we're seeing and hearing from women in the workforce at all levels is that, you know, we have now a national conversation about women's leadership and the issues surrounding women's leadership, whether we're taken seriously or not as leaders, how the media impacts the impressions that women have of themselves and how that helps them advance or lack of an opportunity to advance in the workforce. But it is very clear from all the studies that have been shown that we're not tuned in to the negotiation and the kinds of skills and the kinds of demands that oftentimes our male counterparts are, to say, I did this, I deserve this. We're waiting for someone to say, good girl, atta girl, and mm-hmm. not to say, look what I did, and this is what I deserve for it. So sometimes we do not claim our place or our space or the money that we're accorded. But that does not refute the fact that there are biases that we come against, and there are all of the facts that 63% of the low-paying jobs are held by women. We are still, by rights and by fact, kind of cordoned off into some of the lower-paying environments. So even in those environments, even in that statement, it's going to be a long way to push outside of that.
Well, and I think it's really important to note, too, that, you know, Roz brought up a really good point about kind of educating ourselves about the skills we need to be able to advocate on our own behalf. But there's also the other side of that. Businesses need to take a really hard look at what they're paying their employees, who comprises their employees, what does it actually take to have a really strong workforce and to be able to retain their employees, and really look at, do we have a gender gap going on in our own business that you may not even be aware of? And to really take a hard look at that and start internally in your own business first. And once you start making those kinds of changes, that can cause an amazing ripple effect across businesses across the state.
Women statistically live a little bit longer than men, and typically, at least for women, this is a good thing, but it also means we have to have more saved at the end of our careers.
That is true. And not being, going back to our conversation earlier about financial education, not being a priority for women in schools in terms of being turned away from math or turned away from those kind of things, maybe unconsciously. It's not like there's a math teacher at the door going, you cannot come in, little girl.
Turned off of math, yes, rather than turned away.
Right? That's right. But I think we are starting to change there. And I think that Texas made a huge step in implementing these new criteria for the curriculum in starting in kindergarten, where we're talking about money. We're talking about understanding finances. And that's going to go a long way toward helping girls really learn what they need. But that's many years down the road, right? I mean, we're talking the next generation. What do women need now to be able to do this? These are those financial products when they're doing tax time savings are a huge component for families to be able to save for retirement and put back or invest in a home so that they can have that as asset building for when they retire. Those kinds of things are huge. Having companies offer a 401k option or something like that for their staff is huge. Really even having people understand that you don't have to save $10,000 a year. Even if you start small, that's going to build over time and understanding that it's a long game, that you can start making that little bit of savings and build on it is critically important, and don't just wipe it under the rug because you think you can't save enough right now.
We were talking in the break about policies that allow employees to opt out of saving long-term, like retirement saving, as opposed to requiring them to opt in. Why does that make such a difference?
We have, as we talked about before, the choices that we have to make as oftentimes as single moms. Might that $200 be saved, or might that $200 go to something that my child immediately needs, or that I see is needed? And with a mandated savings program that's supported by your employer, and certainly when there's an employer contribution that's considered to that, it makes that $200 choice not so immediate, but put someone in a viewpoint of a long term. And I think that we oftentimes see everybody that lives on the margin, and the margin can be much more extensive than the poverty line. Everyone who lives on the margin is making decisions in a moment of urgency. And so long term is not in the nomenclature. Long term is not where we're thinking. But if you can take away the sense of urgency and begin to build that sensibility of long term and do it in a very specific, mandated, straightforward fashion, that then women begin and men begin to see that investing in myself and my future is as worthy as addressing that immediate urgent need.
And psychologically, you know, pulling dollars out before you get your paycheck is very different than getting your paycheck and then taking $200 and putting it in your savings account.
That seems harder.
That's more
somehow
painful. Yeah. Yes.
Much, much harder.
Is there anything in this report that represents a bright spot or progress? We've talked a lot about the ways in which women are still behind. Anything that you took away and were excited about?
What we're excited about really is the fact that yes, women have made great gains in education in Texas, and that's a very positive thing. But we're excited about knowing that the data that affects women's economic stability across the state is something that we can all share, and we can all have the same conversation. So that rather than bifurcating our conversation around one issue or another, the housing people all talking about housing, the child care people all talking about child care, that what is helpful and hopeful to me is that we're talking about the full surround of what it takes to be economically viable as a woman in Texas. And that in itself is a positive, because we have too long parsed it all out and not looked at the whole. And I think when we look at the whole, we'll find the whole solutions.
Rosalind Dawson-Thompson is president and CEO of the Dallas Women's Foundation. Francis P. DeVinny is a researcher with the Center for Public Policy Priorities. The Texas Women's Foundation report, Economic Issues for Women in Texas 2014, is available free online. Thank you so much both for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.